Okay, I think we'll get started. It's 4 o'clock. Got a lot to pack, a lot to do today. I do want to go back to Monday. When I introduced these sessions, I said that by the end, I hope that you have a deeper understanding of the need for immediate action in addressing the climate emergency. Recognize that such action will require fundamental and likely disruptive changes, and come away more knowledgeable about the many positive life-affirming ways this can be accomplished, leading to a world even more healthy, just, and connected. Up to now, the focus has primarily been on the first two bullets. And while there's still more to cover there, from this point forward, I'm going to be putting in more stuff having to do with, so what do we do? How do we do this? And before we get into that, though, I do want to read a passage from an essay that a friend sent to me yesterday. it was an essay that was written by a woman who works at a national environmental organization, the Natural Resources Defense Council. And the title of the essay is, "I work in the environmental movement. I don't care if you recycle. Stop obsessing over your environmental sins. Fight the oil and gas industry instead." So I want to read a few passages from this essay because I think it's an important context for how we think about what is it we do about this. "When people come to me and confess their green sins as if I were some sort of eco-nun, I want to tell them they're carrying the guilt of the oil and gas industry's crimes, that the weight of our sickly planet is too much for any one person to shoulder, and that blame paves the road to apathy." Sort of the opposite of what Greta Thunberg said, right? Action begets hope. "That blame paves the road to apathy, which can really seal our doom. But that doesn't mean we do nothing. Climate change is a vast and complicated problem, and that means the answer is complicated too. We need to let go of the idea that it's all of our individual faults, then take on the collective responsibility of holding the true culprits accountable." In other words, we need to become many Davids against one big bad Goliath. And this connects to Mark's session this morning. "While we're busy testing each other's purity, we let the government and industries, the authors of said devastation, off the hook completely. This overemphasis on individual action shames people for their everyday activities, things they can barely avoid doing because of the fossil fuel dependent system that they were born into, that we were born into. If we want to function in society, we have no choice but to participate in that system. To blame us for that is to shame us for our very existence. So we need to broaden our definition of personal action beyond but what we buy, what we use, what we recycle. Start by changing your light bulb, but don't stop there. Taking part in a climate strike or showing up a rally is a personal action. Organizing neighbors to sue a power plant that's poisoning the community is a personal action. Voting is a personal action. When choosing your candidate, investigate their environmental policies. If they aren't strong enough, demand better. Once that person is in office, hold them accountable. And if that doesn't work, run for office yourself. That's another personal action. Take your personal action and magnify it into something bigger than what kind of bag totes your groceries. Here's my confession. I don't care how green you are. I want you in the movement for climate justice. I don't care how long you've been engaged in the climate conversation. I don't need you to be all solar everything to be an environmentalist. I don't need to be veganer than thou, or me for that matter. I don't care if you're eating a burger right this minute, although none of us are doing that, right? And this is important. I don't even care if you work on an oil rig. In some parts of the country, those are the only jobs that pay enough for you to feed your family. And I don't blame workers for that. I blame their employers and the people who finance them. I blame the industry that has choked us all and the government that is letting them do it. All you need to do is want a livable future. This is your planet. No one can advocate it for like you can. No one can protect it like you can. We have 11 years, she wrote this 2 years ago. We only have 9 years. We have 11 years, not to start, but to finish saving the planet. I'm not here to absolve you. I'm not here to abdicate you. I'm here to fight with you. So that's a context I hope you think about in terms of, you know, what is it that you need to do? Yeah, Rick?
Are you able to share?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I have a whole bibliography that I'll put together, you know, and print out for the final session. You have to come to the final session to get the bibliography. You know, I am a business developer kind of guy. I know. So, yes, but I will put together, you know, what I think are some of the... And then I have these PowerPoint slides, so if anybody wants the whole PowerPoint with notes, and, you know, my notes are, you know, just give me your, you know, your card, your email, and I'll send them out to you. All right, so session 3 is on the 3Ds, and as I said, there might be a couple bonus 2Ds. But the first 3Ds that we're going to talk about are decarbonization, distribution, and democratization. And these are three key strategies, I believe, critical to the future world, this great world that we can create out of this crisis. And there are three areas in which I think people can, in fact, start to begin doing things to make that happen. Dave Roberts is somebody I would encourage you to follow. If you can go online and sort of Google his name, he writes for something called Canary Media, and I think his writing about climate and the clean energy revolution is some of the best that's out there. And he coined a phrase, clean electrification is the entree, everything else is a side. On climate policy, there's one main thing, and then there's everything else. It's clean electrification. So he simplifies it in this way. We need to clean up the electricity grid. We talked about that ad infinitum the last couple days. We need to clean up transportation, and we'll talk a little bit about that today, and we need to clean up buildings. And if we do that, we're really a long way towards what we need to do to go to that better world that we're hoping for. So let's start with building decarbonization. We've talked about the decarbonization of the energy source itself, right? Eliminating the use of fossil fuels in the production of electricity and other forms of energy. This is particularly important in replacing the use of internal combustion engines in transportation, with electric vehicles, the electrification of buses, of rail. We talked on the operations tour today about we need to find a way within the next few years to electrify the buses and trucks at Holden. And the board has got some ideas about how to do that. But equally important is replacing gas and oil burning, water and space heating with highly efficient electric heat pump technology. And this is not your grandparents' water heaters, you know, resistance heaters. This is a technology that essentially is a backwards refrigerator. You know, refrigerator cools inside, heats outside. Actually, for the heating purpose, that's what a heat pump does also. But for cooling, it can go the other direction, cool the outside with heating on the inside. And what I hope you could see here, this is an analysis that was done, again, by Lawrence Berkeley Labs that shows that, well, yeah, high-efficiency gas storage of water is pretty cheap, right? You can get a water heater for about $1,000, but your annual cost is about $323 under gas costs over the last couple years. As we saw a couple days ago, those costs are going up, so that number is going to go up. But if you look at electric pump water heaters, again, while the install cost is more like $1,700, the annual cost is only $190. So you're making up that difference within 2 or 3 years. And given that these units generally have an economic useful life, another acronym, EUI, of at least 15 years, you're going to make up that and more pretty quickly. So one of the things you can do, very simply, is when that water heater goes out, or if you've only got a few years left on it and you're willing to go forward, replace it with a heat pump. Then you're going to have electrified your unit. Now, one of the interesting things about heat pumps is that they also are storage devices. So I don't know if anybody was on the tour. How many people were on the operations tour, right? Remember when Steve talked about the fact that when in the evening we've got too much electricity because, you know, the hydro is running and we got to put it somewhere, what do? They heat our hot water heaters here. So then in the morning, we have hot water for our showers. So I actually, in my community where I live, in Sonoma County, we have a program called Sonoma Clean Power, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. It's a community choice agency. And first of all, they gave me an incentive of $750 to put in one of these things. And second, because I hooked it up to some Wi-Fi, they use that as a load balancing device, right? And they pay me $5 a month. But I'm contributing to the ability of that program to do more renewable energy. Because what they're doing essentially is when they've got lots of solar in the afternoon, right? They don't want to shed it. They don't want to send it, pay somebody else to take it. They heat up my water, right? And so that way it's helping the reduction of emissions by making the economics of solar that much better. Now you take thousands of those, and now you really have, you know, what we call a virtual power plant. Essentially, we're storing all that energy and using it when we, you know, power is plentiful and not having to heat it up when power is more expensive and dirtier. Okay, this is going to be the hard one. You know, we're going to talk about disruptive change. You're going to need to get rid of your gas stove. Yeah, it's tough. I know. How many people have tried or used induction cooking? Anybody use it yet? What do you think of it?
Love it.
Yeah, it's really one of those things. It's one of those changes where you go, I'm never going to give up my Wolf stove. I'm a chef. I'm a great cook. And then you get an induction stove and you go, I can't believe I ever cooked on gas. In order to get that incentive that I got for my, you know, hot water, you know, my heat pump water heater, I had to have my stove tested, right, for emissions, right, for nitrous oxide, basically, for emissions. It's part of the program. And to my wife and my surprise and horror, we found out that the air in our kitchen, you know, 20 feet away from the stove, was worse than the worst day in L.A., okay? And next to the stove, you know, forget it. And this is a, you know, high quality gas stove. It's been tuned up, whatever. Your gas stove is emitting really dirty stuff. And if you do have a gas stove, I will tell you right now, please turn on your fan every single time, even if you don't have a grease fire. Because in terms of the pollution that's going into your house, you don't want it in your house. Now, you don't want it in the environment either, but better that it goes out there than in your house. And better yet, when the time comes, get that induction stove. And you won't go back because they really are fantastic. And again, most utilities will, within the next 3, 5, 7 years, have incentives. They will pay you money to do it because they're not cheap. Yeah, money.
So what's the technology on it? I'm not familiar with
it. It's basically I'm a mile wide and an inch deep, but it's basically magnets, and the magnets do something. Maybe you guys know, do something to the molecules in the pan, and it heats it up. It's kind of like how's that for an engineering kind of answer? I've never pretended to be an engineer, but it's basically so you can literally put your hand on it and it's not hot, right? You never burn yourself. It's like, I guess, like a microwave in that respect, right? I mean, it's like a microwave for your stove. You only gets hot when you put the pan on it. Yeah.
You have to have old steel pans.
You have to have old. So you have to have steel pans.
Moving don't work. It's got to be steel.
Got to be steel pans for it to work. Yeah. It's electric. Yeah. So that's the whole idea, right? The decarbonization strategy is about using clean electricity because gas, as we saw yesterday, has got problems. There's the gas problems of coming out of your stove, but there's all that leakage we talked about yesterday that's really bad for the environment, right? But just so you know, you will be seeing ads from your gas company, you know, trying to tell you that, you know, you're going to, you know, what is it? I'm going to take my dead hand. What was, you know, the actor who was the head of the NRA? You know, you're going to have to take my hands off my gun. Whatever. You know, they're going to pull this emotional thing of, you know, you're not going to take away my gas stove. You know, take away my water heater, okay, whatever. But my gas stove, no way. You're going to see those ads, believe me. You know, what I'm getting at is that, you know, buildings, cows, and GHGs, oh my, you know. Lions and tigers and bears? Okay, you don't get it. In fact, buildings account for, we're talking about the water heater, the gas stove, the space heater, 13% of the greenhouse gases in the U.S. And ironically, in terms of the industrial contribution, right, that 23%, 7 to 8% of all carbon dioxide emissions from steelmaking is from steelmaking, and 7 to 8% is from making cement. So of that 23%, 14% is steel and cement, and 40% of the steelmaking is to build what?
Buildings.
Roads. Pipelines for oil, steel structures for oil, ships to ship oil, train cars to ship oil. 40% of the steel made in this country is for the oil and gas infrastructure. So we get rid of gas and oil eventually. We don't need to make dirty steel. And there are new technologies for making cleaner steel. I know this is going to be hard for some of you. At least a third of what accounts for the agricultural emissions, about 3%, is from enteric fermentation. Does anybody know what that is?
Cows.
Cow what?
The digestive system.
Cow burps. Yeah, people think it's cow, you know what, but no, it's cow burps. Another reason to think about going vegetarian. So what do you do about this? Okay, how do you, what do you do about, you got gas stoves, you got gas water heaters, gas space heaters, these are all things that you can start looking at your capital plan, right? Your food, how you eat food. Now, here's one little story. So I was visiting my brother in Charlotte, North Carolina for Thanksgiving. My brother's a little bit of an odd guy, but a really amazing, smart guy. And he's a vegetarian, complete vegetarian, vegan, the whole nine yards. And he did put together a turkey for us for Thanksgiving, but, he's a complete vegetarian. But then I noticed one morning he was making his coffee with those little curd cups, those little plastic things. And I was like, wow, that's so wasteful, Chuck. I mean, why would you do that? He said, well, I'm not very technological. When I make coffee, it just doesn't work. I just stick it in, it works. I said, well, I really would like you to stop using it. He said, okay, well, let's make a deal. I said, what's that? He said, if I stop using those cups, you stop eating meat. And so we made a deal. So I don't eat beef anymore. And he doesn't use the curry cups. I only give this example to say there's all kinds of little deals you can make with yourself and your friends to reduce your carbon footprint. And I really don't miss the beef, I have to be honest. I eat pork, which has problems. I eat chicken, that has problems too, but I've given up beef. So for whatever it's worth, there's ways of making that happen.
Question.
Yeah. Cows are the worst, yeah, because of the nature of and again, there's probably farmers here who know better than I do what difference is in terms of how cows process their food that they produce that much more methane, yeah.
So how do you propose that, for instance, my brother is a cattle rancher.
Yeah.
How can I talk with him about this?
Probably don't want to talk to him about this strategy. No, it's interesting. I have a very close friend. I've known him since college. Grew up in Texas, West Texas, 200,000-acre ranch. He finally, over the years, has sold off his property. He's down to a herd for breeding, but he sold off pretty much everything else for hunting. And part of that is because, it's really hard to make money in Texas now because of water problems with ranching, but that's how he made that transition. Is he a lot of rich people out of Austin want to have a place to go hunt, so that's what he did. Unfortunately, there's no silver bullet on getting people to change these things, but you know, you got to find the place and the time and you know, maybe, you know. The other thing he did, oh, by the way, is I got him to, he's leased his land to a wind developer, not to do windmills, but to have right-of-way for transmission lines for windmills, and so he's helped in that way. So maybe your brother has land that is, you know, good for wind. Maybe he's got land that's in a place where transmission would be helpful for moving renewables. You got to find, you got to work at it. Not necessarily just, again, going back to that essay earlier, we don't want to blame people for the choices they had to make to live the life they had to live, but let's find ways to, you know, get into some new ideas. All right, I'm falling behind. But these are really good questions, so keep asking them, please. So we need to talk about, so that's the decarbonization D. The second D, and this one's a little more complicated, is the distribution one, right? Distributed energy. The idea that solar panels on homes, solar panels on schools, businesses, distributed energy is also, frankly, in the lexicon of the folks that I work with, those water heaters, that's considered a distributed energy resource because it is something that you can use to manage the flow of energy at a local level. I talked about the virtual power plant that thousands of these, you know, water heaters working together can provide to the grid. And electric vehicles are also considered distributed energy resources because, as I've talked to some of you, right, like you perhaps some of you have heard that Ford has come out with a new electric F-150. It has a battery and it has a connection where you can plug it into your house and you can use it as backup for your house or, frankly, again, thousands of Ford F-150s aggregated together by your utility or your load-serving entity, as it's called, is a virtual power plant where they're taking your excess energy and using it to manage the grid or provide energy. So this model of distributed resources is one that is very current right now. And to understand it, we have to understand the grid a little bit. So I'm going to do a little nerd thing here, and then we'll get into some of the ideas about how you can work with it. So first, some basics. There's two major components to the grid, right? There's the, in terms of, this is the grid is the thing that moves electricity from where you generate it to where you use it. There's the transmission grid, right? These big towers. And then there's the distribution grid, which is where you're going from what are called a substation, a distribution substation, to a home or a business or whatever. The transmission grid has a substation that basically takes the voltage and a bunch of other stuff that we won't get into, makes the electricity so that it can go into the distribution grid, and then the distribution substation makes it to the electricity. You can use it at home. It doesn't fry things. The existing grid was designed, this is the important piece, and built to carry energy from centralized locations to load centers, in other words, homes, businesses, whatever, where the power is needed, through large high-voltage transmission lines, again, stepped down so that they can be used locally, okay? And that process is managed by these large grid operators, primarily known as independent system operators. We have one in California called CAISO, California Independent System Operator. This winter, you heard a lot about ERCOT, the Electricity Reliability Council of Texas. It's interesting they put that in their name. You know, they got into a lot of trouble, and pretty much their entire board has been replaced because they kind of screwed up. You know, the folks here who are from the Midwest, there's the MISO, Midwest Independent System Operator. They have these like Star Trek-like centers. That picture doesn't really do justice, where they are managing all the flow of the electricity in their geographical territory, right? And their job primarily is to make sure, A, there's enough electricity to meet the load, and B, there's not too much. It's sort of like a Goldilocks thing. It's what's known as load balancing. You can't, you know, electricity is kind of like water. If you have too much, you flood. If you have too little, you have drought. But electricity, you have to keep it in balance. Yes?
So what happened in Texas?
In Texas, basically, they two things. Well, I should say this. There are multiple million-dollar studies going on to answer that question. But the so this is the opinion from somebody who's read somebody who has an opinion. And basically, they did not anticipate the degree to which this climate event, right? And you know, we talk about global warming, but part of what with global warming is changing the nature of winds, right, around the globe. And they had this major polar vortex that just took, you know, the weather from North Dakota. I heard about somebody at lunch was telling me about how he has fun going outside, taking boiling water and throwing in the air and watching the water explode at 25 below. Well, that they're prepared for that, right? Texas was not prepared for that. Their transmission lines, you know, they had not invested in the technology that keeps those transmission lines working properly under extra cold conditions was one of the main problems. And the demand increased because people have lots of electric heat there, and they didn't have sufficient, the power plants that were supposed to come online to power that didn't come online. Initially, of course, the governor blamed it on renewable energy, right? That renewable energy didn't provide enough power, and then it turned out, no, actually, the renewable energy plants work better than the gas plants. So he had to take his words back. But it was a transmission issue because of the cold, and it was the gas plants that just couldn't operate under those conditions. Yeah.
Are you familiar with the work that Schweitzer Engineering in Portland, Washington is doing with the grid?
I'm not. And we're all in bated breath wanting to know. Uh-huh. Figuring out some grid solutions. Yeah. No, there. One of the stories lines right now is, again, grid was designed to manage under conditions where you had generation centralized, and then you distributed it. It was also organized under conditions that assumed a certain weather pattern, and not the heat domes that we got in the Northwest, not the polar vortexes we got in the South, not the wildfires that we have in California, not the hurricanes that we have in the Southeast. Grid was not designed to handle those conditions. And so there are lots of engineering firms and lots of folks trying to figure out, okay, there was that OSH moment, right? What the do we do now? Because this is not going away, right? First 2 days of this session, these events, these extreme weather events are going to happen. They're going to happen more frequently and more violently. The grid is not set up to handle that. So we need folks like working on that. Now the other threat, another one just to be clear, is cybersecurity. Because the grid, you know, is a data system also. And there is no question that we are very vulnerable to somebody coming in and shutting it down. The Russians did it to the Ukrainians, you know, during their war. They pretty much shut down their grid several times just to kind of show that they could do it. They probably were doing it to show they could do it to us more than they were doing it to Ukraine. But that's another risk of a, and this, I'm getting to my story here, of a big grid. And the only other one, the other story I want to tell about is, in my previous life as an organizational consultant, I was working with the Bay Area Rapid Transit System. Anybody ridden on BART in the Bay Area? Yeah, big system. It was designed in the 60s, primarily by people who had been working in aerospace and rocketry. They were rocket scientists who designed BART. But when I started working with them in the 80s, it had been after there had been several events where the whole system had gone down and trains had gotten stuck under the bay. It's not something you want to have happen, right? You don't want to be sitting in a train car under the bay, right? And I was talking to this engineer, and he said, well, you need to understand, Rick, we designed this as one system. And he said, when large systems go down, they go down big. And that's the vulnerability, one of the vulnerabilities of these large systems, right? These large centralized systems. They're vulnerable because, you know, transmission lines, as we've talked about, are vulnerable to extreme weather events, hurricanes, tornadoes, trees fall on lines. I mean, ice accumulates, like in Texas, on the lines, and the lines can't, you know, continue to operate. Last year, 22 of the natural disasters that struck the United States each cost more than $1 billion in damages and repairs. The total losses associated with natural disasters in 2020 alone accounted for $74 billion. So when people tell you that it's going to be expensive to go to a more distributed system, this is the story I'm kind of coming to, what they're comparing is like that nuclear thing. Oh, yeah, you know, nuclear power is really cheap. Oh, but when you have to shut it down, they don't build that cost into the model, right? And the same with these centralized systems. This $74 billion, that's when there's, you know, debates in the legislature and policy, they don't talk about what it's going to, because that's a disaster. That's a unexpected thing. Well, it's not unexpected anymore, right? We have to build that into our models, into our financial models. So that's why many of us in the field feel like it's not just a good thing because it allows people to participate in solving the climate problem. It's a good thing because it's having a more mixed model, a distributed model, reduces the risks. Okay. Oh, there it is. Yeah. This is a grid outage. Okay. So what would a grid that's designed to support a more distributed model look like? One way to think about the grid is like it's like an irrigation system. It pushes water from one or more sources to many endpoints, right? And when resources need to be able to move from any point in the network, it needs to operate more like a transportation system. Transportation networks accept traffic from anywhere, right? It can go anywhere. This is something that we need to start thinking about as we have a million solar roofs in California, right? Now it's not just these centralized power plants. And again, you solar power plants, wind farms, great, right? But now we have a million, and at this point, about 1.2 million solar plants spread around in California. We have to have a grid that is managed to be able to accommodate all that. And oh, by the way, it's a more resilient grid because now when the grid goes down, it doesn't go down quite as big because there's all these other places that are able to provide resource. I've talked a couple times, I've quoted from a guy named Tony Seba, who was the guy who predicted the cost of solar 12 years ago right on, and is now saying we can get to net zero with current technologies by 2035. And he said this, and this is important to me, so hopefully you'll appreciate it. Unlike fossil fuels, nuclear power, even hydropower, the ability to deploy solar and batteries virtually anywhere at any scale will lead to the localization, decentralization, and democratization of energy production. This new, more stable and resilient energy production system will also allow less developed countries and communities to close poverty and equity gaps by leapfrogging over previous barriers to human development. We're already seeing this happen in parts of Africa. We saw this with the phones, right? There's, you know, cell phones in parts of the world where they didn't have to put up all the wires and landlines. They just went to cell phones. We can do that same thing with energy in some of these communities. And to get to finally, I think, Monty's question the other day, the centralized model is also expensive. And again, I'm sorry this chart isn't that clear, but the point is that the fastest growing component of energy right now, because solar has grown so much and it's really cheap, and wind has grown so much and it's really cheap, the actual provision of electricity cost has been going down. Where you're getting the cost increases is in the transmission infrastructure, partially because they all of a sudden got it. They have to ruggedize these transmission systems because the climate events are getting worse and the system is not set up to handle it. So there's that cost. But the other reason is because, anybody know how your utility makes money? Private utilities, investor-owned utilities, co-ops, you know, public utilities, not the same, but where do they make their money from? Anybody know? This is really important. Investor-owned utilities, which cover about 80% of the distribution of energy in this country, do not make money selling power. Think about that for a second. They don't make their money selling you power. They have processes within their various regulatory commissions rate-making processes where basically they do cost recovery. Whatever it costs them to buy the power and what money they get back from you has to kind of equal out. Where they make their money is they have a guaranteed rate of return anywhere from 10 to 14%, in California it's 12%, on any capital deployed. Think about that for a second. So when they're spending money to build a transmission line or a substation or put up a pole or, this is the ironic part, or fix transmission lines that have gone down because of climate events, right? Or fires caused by their lines going down because they didn't maintain those lines properly in the first place, they get a guaranteed rate of return of 10 to 12% on all capital deployed. That's where they get their money, okay? From their regular, from their local, you know, they get to put it into your, no, they get it from you. It's in your bill. So your T&D charge, it's called different things on different bills because they don't want you to understand what it is. Your transmission and distribution portion of your electric bill is paying them that 12% rate of return on capital that they've deployed. Now, they're saying, well, we need those wires. We need those substations. We need all that stuff, right? And that's, you know, yes, that's true. We need those engineering firms to come up with ways to harden the grid, but it's under a model that's focused on that centralized approach because it's actually more expensive to create a grid that is fully centralized and, you know, in that way, then to have what I'm proposing and what many of us are proposing, which is a mixed model, where you have some of those grid services performed not by very expensive substations, but by the inverter in your, who has solar here, right? You have an inverter at your house. Your inverter actually does a function, which is frequency regulation and voltage control, which is what that substation that costs $3 million does. Now, you can't do as much, but in there are models out there which are called non-wire alternatives where your inverter and maybe another 100 inverters in your neighborhood, when managed properly, can replace a substation, right? It can do the same function of balancing the load, of balancing the frequency, the voltage, and all that kind of stuff that that substation was doing. But that cost, he paid for it, right? They don't get to charge you for that capital expenditure, right? They don't get their 12% rate of return. So they've been fighting this non-wire, you know, through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I mean, this is all nerdy stuff, but the battle that's going on is to keep the current model so that these models, which, oh, by the way, if you they did have you do that, they'd have to pay you for that service, right? And you'd make money on it. And they don't want you to make money, right? Right? So that's one piece. Now, the other piece is what's known as the transmission access charge. There's a charge on your bill for the fact that you, not just for the capital that's been expended to build that infrastructure. There's a charge on your bill called the transmission access charge. And again, it's hidden under various names that you would never figure out, where basically you're being charged because you're using the transmission grid. You have your access to that grid. But if you've got solar, right, at your home, you're not using that transmission grid except for in the evening. You're not using it during the day. You're still being charged the same amount of money as your neighbor, even though you're not using it. And so, of course, they don't want people to have solar at home because then they won't be able to charge that transmission. Because, oh, by the way, that money they also get. It's not. That's not part of the cost recovery. That's profit for them, okay? So those are two of the ways. So one of the arguments that the centralized people say is, well, we can do a power plant, you know, at 3 cents a kilowatt hour out in the desert. What they don't tell you is that, oh, yeah, and we put another 4 cents for that transmission access charge. Versus if we used his solar and again 100 other solar when he for the you know he doesn't use all the power that he's producing. He's exporting power to the grid, right? And right. His neighbors are using it, right? But if we set up a system that aggregated all those local resources so that we didn't need as much of that transmission, you would lower all your costs. You would reduce the amount of capital, you would reduce the amount you're paying for those transmission resources that you don't need. Okay, a story. Oh, and oh, by the way, centralized systems are really dangerous. On Monday, the district attorney in Shasta County filed criminal charges against PG&E for the people who died in the Zog fire. And you know, again, we don't need to go through all that, but the centralized system is really dangerous, right? When you have these high voltage electric lines going through forests and ridgetops, and you have, you know, winds, and oh, by the way, the utility skimps. Well, the reason they're going to lose on this case is it's absolutely clear that PG&E skimped on the required maintenance and removal of, you know, trees and so forth near these wires that caused this fire. So, but that's a whole other story. Okay, we need to move along here. Yeah. Oh, one more thing about this. A story. So remember the Clovis Unified School District? You know, 45,000 students, they put in, they early went in, did solar, even though, you know, it was a little bit of a squeeze for them because they thought of it as this environmental thing, but then they realized, oh, we're going to save a lot of money. Tea Party, you know, chairman, you know, promoted the bond measure. That's great. So 5 years later, they've got 25 megawatts, right, of solar powering their schools and, oh, by the way, in the summer when schools close, exporting power to their community, right, at a lower cost than what they would if they had to buy it from, you know, a distance. 2017, our friends at PG&E announced they're canceling a transmission project known as the Huron-Fresno project, a $450 million project. They're canceling it because the growth in distributed energy resources in the Fresno area no longer made it, it wasn't needed anymore, right? In other words, and they said the growth of about 120 megawatts of solar in that area. Clovis was about 25 of those megawatts. Several of the other school districts that I work with were about another 30 megawatts. So about half of the DERs that went in that made it no longer necessary for this transmission project, they canceled this project, saving ratepayers $450 million. So what do you think the superintendent did? He called me up. He saw the headline in the local newspaper. PG&E saving you $450 million, right? Otherwise, they're losing $45 million, right, in profits. But forget that. PG&E saving you $450 million. We're canceling this project. What did the superintendent call me and say? Where's mine? Right? My constituents paid for the solar that saved these ratepayers $450 million. How come the school district isn't? Come on, Rick. Where's my money? I mean, literally, he was like, why shouldn't I get part of that? Right? We're paying for it. This is the point being, you know, this, the model that we have today, the policies we have today are, you know, stacked against us in terms of moving this direction of more distributed and I would say democratic model. All right. Oh, gosh. You know, we may have to slop over till tomorrow with some stuff. One more thing about distributed, and this has to do with the safety and dangerous issue. In 2017, we had something called the Camp Fire in Sonoma County. You probably all heard about it, where several thousand homes were destroyed, including, unfortunately, the home of one of our very close friends. We were smelling smoke in the afternoon and wondering what was going on. Maybe it was the evening, in the middle of the night. And about 2 hours later, we got a phone call from Steve and Linda. Can we come over? We got to get out. You know, they literally got out of their house with their clothes on their back and their one car. And we became a shelter for the next 6 weeks, right? Because their house, toast. We happen to live in a part of the county that is surrounded by dairy farms, so there's not, you know, forests. We're not at the wildland interface. We were fine. And actually, over the next 3 years, two out of the next three fire seasons, we also had people who had to come, who were evacuated, not because they lost their homes, but they were evacuated because of the danger of fires coming through. We are not ready, as that quote we had yesterday from the Obama, we're not ready for the world that we live in. These disasters are going to be coming more often. And so what does this have to do with distributed? Well, we need resilience hubs. We need community resilience hubs. And what are resilience hubs? Resilience hubs are places where power is continuous, meaning it has local solar and a battery and a little microgrid controller so that when the grid goes down, and it's when, not if, people have a place to go. Steve and Linda were lucky that they could come to our house. They had friends who could do that. But Tracy, in her role in public health, you know, was involved in helping set up shelters that held 2,000-3,000 people around the county at places that really weren't ready for them. And luckily, they were in locations where the grid didn't go down. I think the emergency operations center that she was in, you had to move once, right? Because didn't you have to move the center? You had to go to another place because...
Because
the fire was coming. But the point being, we are not prepared for what's coming. And one of the ways to get prepared is to plan for resilience before the disaster. Meaning, let's set up these community resilience hubs. In California, we have over 2,000 schools, I've done 300, that have solar, right? And only a fraction, though, have batteries. So we need to get batteries into those schools, because schools are the natural place that people can go to. And this is not just for when the grid goes down because of fire, it's also these extreme heat events, right, where you need to have cooling centers, where people who don't have AC or their AC goes out, they have to go someplace. Or, you know, people die. I mean, I think there was a town in BC where a couple hundred people died because of extreme heat. So that's another part or another rationale for a distributed model, is we need to invest in those kind of resources. Happily, California budget signed this week put $100 million into resilience centers. Now, that may sound like a lot for those of you who are in states that have 500,000, 600,000 people. That's nothing for California. We need, you know, many, many times that to create these resilience centers. Many of us lobbied hard. At least we got the $100 million. So that's another reason why we need to do that. So we need a mixed model. And again, this mixed model of both centralized and decentralized or distributed is going to be cheaper for some of the reasons we've talked about in terms of these ridiculous costs for a transmission grid that's built, overbuilt, to deal with a centralized system that's dangerous, vulnerable, and expensive. That's the wrong way to do things. We need a mixed model. There was a study done this spring that showed that California ratepayers can save $120 billion over the next 30 years with this mixed model. But it requires policies that don't stop the growth of distributed solar. And as we'll be talking about tomorrow, unfortunately, yes, progressive California is doing just that. California policy is going backwards. It is not the model. I'll tell you right now. Okay, let's see what we're going to do here. It's 4:48, and we haven't done democratization yet. And that's a big topic. And so I think what I want to do is see if there are specific questions about what we've talked about in terms of decarbonization and distributed energy. And maybe we'll stop here, and I'll put the democratization piece into tomorrow, which makes sense because tomorrow is policy and politics, and so democratization kind of fits in that way. And if we don't have a lot of questions, you get to leave early. Yeah, Rick.
Well, this may be a little bit Star Wars-y.
Yeah.
But I was watching the program talking about transferring energy for the Teslas.
Yeah.
Is there any... Transferring energy for the Teslas.
Yes.
Through the air. Is there any local distribution that would be practical?
Through the air. That I don't know about. No.
Well, in the early part of the century, Tesla apparently was
Nikola Tesla. Yes, yeah. You know, there have been there. I don't know much about this. There have been discussions around putting solar panels, huge solar arrays in space. You know, orbiting the Earth, and then, you know, through some microwave technology, sending it down. Here's what I have to say about the general issue, and I kind of alluded to it yesterday. My biggest worry right now, besides the predatory behavior of fossil fuel interests and utilities and finance folks who are aligned with them to hold on to their model, right, to their centralized capital-intensive model. Besides that, the biggest threat, I think, to us actually doing the things we need to do are the whiz bang folks, the people who are saying, oh, let's, you know, and unfortunately, Bill Gates is one of them. I respect him in a lot of ways, but he is putting his money into inventing new things. And great, that's not going to help what we need to do in this period of the next, you know, 7 to 9 years. We have the technology today. We have, you know, wind, solar, battery technology today. It's been confirmed by a Stanford professor, this guy Tony Seba, the Department of Energy. By the way, it was the Department of Energy scientists under the previous administration who did this study. Okay, so it's not like it's the people trying to push a particular agenda. The science is clear. We have the technology today. We just have to deploy it. We just have to make it happen. We don't need the other whiz-bang ideas. And my concern is that people get, focused on this new, the next shiny, next shiny penny, and that distracts from the fact that we need to put, people's minds, their hands. We need electricians, by the way, folks. That, one of the biggest risks we have to do this deployment over the next 7 to 9 years, we know we have a problem at Holden finding, right, tradespeople. That's a big issue. In deploying all this, because this is all electrical stuff, right? We need electricians, and we don't have them. And so one thing you can do, find out, who's working on at your community college on creating certification courses, and get them to create courses to crank out, these are good jobs. I mean, these are well-paying jobs. You don't have to have a full, 4-year degree. But anyway, the distraction issue is one I'm really worried about. Yeah.
What countries are doing it right or more right?
Unfortunately, it's not that binary. It's more sort of the country that's doing it the rightest is New Zealand, right? I mean, they're going all in. I would say that I know of, right? But again, because it's a whole portfolio of things that need to be done. I mean, Norway. See, I'm appealing to your self-interest, right? You always got to look for how do you appeal to people's self-interest. Norway is doing electric vehicles right, right? I mean, they're basically paying people to buy an electric vehicle, and they're taxing people hugely. I mean, I heard latest, it's like if you buy an ICE car, you pay $30,000 on top of the price of the car to buy an internal combustion engine car. So you're not going to buy an internal combustion engine car in Norway. So different countries are doing different things, but New Zealand, Australia is like this, there's certain provinces in Australia who are doing it absolutely right. They're going completely distributed with batteries. I mean, they've got some of the biggest battery systems in place that are basically putting coal plants and gas-fired plants out of business, linked to solar. There's no one great model. I mean, frankly, the United States is doing it really well. I mean, relative to the world. Look, without China, we wouldn't be here. Game over. Because remember, did I do a thing on manufacturing of solar panels? No, I didn't do that. So maybe I'm telling a story. So remember that there's the investment tax credit we talked about that George Bush, ran through in 2005. There's the California Solar Initiative. I'm taking away from tomorrow's session, but let's just do it anyway. That Arnold Schwarzenegger put through, right, in California, that put this huge incentive demand, right, for power. Germany, Spain, Italy did something called FIT programs. Again, meaning buy or sell. If you build a solar plant, we'll pay you, right? This was all in the mid-2000s. U.S. had the most solar manufacturing at that time, right? What happened? The Chinese said, oh my gosh, there's gonna be this huge demand for solar panels. And the Chinese government gave low interest loans to companies in China, and they basically took over solar panel manufacturing within 5 years. our government, you know, oh, no, no, this is a private sector thing. The government can't get involved in this, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, and what happened to solar panel prices? Came down. You know, it wasn't technology. It wasn't a technological. There's some improvement in panels based on engineering, but it was about economies of scale and production, and the Chinese produced it. So who did it right? Who's doing it right? China did it right on solar panels. We wouldn't be here without China, period. We'd be toast. They got the signal, the supply signal, I mean demand signal, and they supplied it.
And are they using them?
Yeah, they're putting in more panels than we are. But they're a bigger country, and they're still building coal plants. Yeah. So it's, you know, again, folks, you gotta live with contradiction if you're gonna be working in this field. You know, there's no purity. Where's Mark? No purity. Yeah, right here. Yeah.
Ricky, many of the things you've said include batteries.
Right.
And
batteries are critical.
Run right past that.
Yeah.
And just saying that. And yet, from what I've read, lithium mining, lithium waste,
right.
There are all these kind of side effects
right.
that really should be factored in
right.
to all of this. So I wish that you
could. Sure. So remember we did that little exercise yesterday on, you know, solar versus habitats, right? I'm gonna say, you know, it's the same contradictory trade-off dynamic. If we didn't have batteries, we'd be toast. So there is a cost, right? The environmental costs associated with mining, whatever, of lithium. That you have to take a look at that cost against the benefit. And at this point, the conclusion I come to is the benefit is thousands of times greater. Because without batteries, we're not able to provide energy, electricity, 24/7. Right? The wind doesn't go all day long. The sun doesn't shine all day long. We have to have batteries to power things when there isn't power. And for transportation. We have to electrify transportation, we have to have batteries. Now, there are new technologies that are emerging that use less lithium, that use iron, more iron, and they will be coming online in the next 2 or 3 years. But would I want to stop lithium mining today because I want to wait for that? We don't have time to do that. That's my conclusion. So, yes, it's a problem, but what problem do you want? I want a planet that doesn't go to, you know, 3 degrees Celsius the next 20 years. And so, yes, they're remember, I keep saying, this is going to be disruptive. Part of that disruption is accepting that there are going to be bad things that happen. There's going to be pain. It's not just, this is not all, okay, we found the magic bullet, everything's going to be great. There are going to be costs associated with it. I think we have time for one or two more questions. Yeah.
I was going to ask about the battery question as well. I've heard a lot of conversation about the problem with making all the batteries.
Yeah.
And she asked the same question.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah. 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 There's problems. I think those problems are de minimis in relation to the solution that those batteries are providing for us. That's my opinion. You know, other people may come down different place. Yeah, go ahead, sorry. Yeah?
Just to add to that, is the federal government subsidizing the development of better battery technology?
In so they haven't been over the last 4 years.
They should.
They shouldn't?
They should.
They should, yeah. They haven't been the last 4 years. The new administration has already, you know, basically reconstituted a program within the Department of Energy that provides both technology support and low-cost financing for these new technologies. And in the bill that, you know, we keep talking about the budget reconciliation bill, the bill that's hopefully gonna pass in some form this week or next week, there is a number of different things that are both to incentivize the deployment by lowering the financing cost that we've talked about, but also supply chain issues. You know, providing money for doing more domestic battery manufacturing and more environmentally safe lithium mining. There's a major source in California. Anybody know about the Salton Sea? Anybody heard about the Salton Sea? A major source where, again, because it's in California, it's going to have to abide by certain environmental requirements that nowhere else has, if it gets up and running. But there's a lot of money going in there, including Tesla money. So, yeah. And I think we'll have our last question, then we have to go.
In addition to giving up our gas stoves,
yes.
What about traveling by air?
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Tracy and I just had a very interesting experience. We have a group of friends, my men's group that I've been with for almost 50 years, and their partners had planned to go to Sicily next year, next September, a year from now, as sort of a gathering, 50-year anniversary kind of trip. And one of the participants, Tracy had found a great place to go. we blocked out our time. Basically had an epiphany and said, I can't justify, 11 people flying to Sicily, given, what's going on. She was somebody who, was really impacted by the events this summer. So we canceled the trip, and we're going to go somewhere in the Northwest, maybe to BC, in our electric cars, in some cases. It's a major issue. Yeah. And we all need to really look carefully at what is necessary travel by air.
And their technology seems to just take so long.
Yeah, it's going to take...
They build a plane, even, and they'll transfer it into some kind of other...
There will be, this time next year, there will be short hop, meaning 300 mile less electric planes flying in this country. Yeah, so there are people are working on it.
Yeah.
But, Thank you all. We'll see you tomorrow.